Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How did the British prepare for nuclear war during the Cold War? What was the worst-case scenario if thermonuclear weapons were to be used? I'm your host, James Rogers. This is the Warfare Podcast, and in this episode from the History Hit Archives, Dan Snow talks to Julie McDowell about surviving a nuclear attack and how Britain might have remade itself in the aftermath of Armageddon. These are all strangely pertinent questions for the world we find ourselves in today. Enjoy.
Julie, thanks so much for coming on History Hit.
Thank you for inviting me.
I mean, you are the hottest historian in town at the moment, but I'm really fascinated by your research on what Britain was going to do in the event of nuclear Armageddon. And it's one of those things that, for the planners, it's such an overwhelming proposition. And yet, I suppose they had to make, even if they thought all contingencies would be wiped out, they had to make a plan, I guess.
That's true, yes. In my work, I often paraphrase Taylor Swift and say, planners gonna plan. That's their job. So in the Home Office, which did most of the planning, obviously they were told we need to drop plans for example, the NHS and how to evacuate cities, for example. And even if they knew it was futile, the fact is the bosses said, we need this done. So it had to be done. And I just imagine, I have some sympathy for civil servants in the Cold War. I imagine them writing this and secretly thinking, oh, for goodness sake, this is nonsense. But they had to do it because the boss said, get it done.
And did they draw heavily on the experience of the Blitz, or was it looking at the experience of the Japanese, the German cities that suffered so awfully during the Second World War? What were they using?
I think the Cold War can be split in two. The early part of the Cold War, which was the atomic age, of course, they did lean heavily on plans from the Blitz. And quite naively, they thought we could just transplant everything from the Blitz, which worked well, of course. Civil defence, ARP, etc. The rescue squads, that all worked with conventional bombing. And there was a naive hope that this will work with atomic bombing. And there is a kernel of truth in that. An atomic bomb is, in theory, survivable if it's not, you know, blanketed across the whole country. But once the thermonuclear age began and we had the hydrogen bomb, that made all these plans utterly redundant, utterly useless, because there is no defence against the hydrogen bomb. That can turn a city into dust. So a rescue squad is futile when your city is radioactive dust.
God, I don't know how you get through the day with given your research material. It must be terrifying. But so yeah, talk me through different atomic bombs. So at Hiroshima, it's something like a mile radius was sort of destroyed, but there was life in the parts of the city, and it was
yes. Yeah. And there were survivors, of course. People managed to duck into shelters and survive. And of course, the main thing was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They survived because they had the rest of the country, and of course, America in particular, to come in and rescue and rebuild. But if we had an all-out atomic war now, there's no one to rescue you, because if it's an all-out war, that's like Dresden begging for help during the war from, say, Hamburg. You're both equally destroyed. There's no help coming. So that's why the plans became futile in the thermonuclear age, because there's no one to help you. If it's an all-out war, Britain in particular, because we're so compact and heavily populated with a target at the end of every street practically, we could easily have been wiped out in the thermonuclear age by, say, 12 to 15 thermonuclear bombs. And of course, if you manage to dodge the blast, the fallout will get you. And if you manage to dodge the blast and the fallout, then you've got the collapse of society to contend with, the lack of food, the nuclear winter, the starvation, crop failure, anarchy. So there's no way to, if you survive one obstacle, thermonuclear war throws up another and then another until everyone's gone. That's my thinking.
Yeah, you want to be killed in the first wave.
Yes, you do. You want to be gone. You want to be evaporated instantly.
Well, I live very close to Portsmouth Naval Base, so I'm fine. me and the kids are out.
You're gone instantly. You're fine.
So talk me through, in terms of history, when does the atomic age give way to the thermonucleation? Can you tell me a little bit? You've talked about the level of destruction, but how much larger is the yield of those warheads?
Well, with a thermonuclear bomb, obviously the yield can be... Later in the Cold War, the yield could be whatever you wanted. You could actually dial on the bombs what you wanted. So you could, the president could get out his little cards, which he always carries in his pocket, known as the biscuit, that's the nickname for it, and he could choose what he wanted. There are what's called menus in the briefcase that he always carries around with him. So he could choose a menu for what he wanted, choose which targets, which yield is going to be on each bomb. So really you can mix and match your nuclear bombs for ultimate destruction. But really, if a hydrogen bomb falls on the city, there's no hope for you at all. But so it's completely different from the atomic age. Atomic age, yes, you could survive, and yes, some of our Second World War plans could have worked, but by the time the nuclear age turns to the thermonuclear, there's no point planning. All you can do is plan to avoid it, not plan to survive it.
And what date is that?
The hydrogen bomb came around in the 60s, so we had a period where, of course, in the late 40s, it was just America who had the atomic bomb. Then, of course, the Russians very quickly caught up, and then the rest of us, little Britain and little France, tried to tag along. But then when the hydrogen bomb made itself clear in the 60s, and there was a report written by the British government called the Strath Report, which wasn't full of all the silly British, euphemisms, trying to, underplay what it was. The Strath Report was famous for being very blunt and telling the government, this is what the hydrogen bomb will do. And that's when things changed. That's when we knew that all our nice nostalgia of the Blitz was useless now because we were in a totally different world.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the plans for the atomic age, because you've looked into those. What strikes you about those plans now? Actually, was it a serious attempt, or does the whole thing just strike you as just a, as you say, planners gonna plan, just window dressing?
It was quite serious and quite hopeful in the atomic age because we still had the Civil Defence Corps. They were disbanded in 1968, partly because of money, the way Britain was in the 60s, partly because of money, but also partly because people were no doubt realising in government it's futile. But in the late 40s, 50s, early 60s, we still had the Civil Defence Corps. They were training hard to rescue people from rubble. And they had a welfare section, mainly ladies from the Women's Royal Voluntary Service, who, of course, were invaluable during the Blitz. They were known during the Blitz as the army Hitler forgot. He could bomb the city, but then these women were going to arrive to rescue everyone and dish out soup and tea and keep them safe and warm with blankets and with first aid. So they were still involved, and they're often mocked because in the thermonuclear age, they still thought, we're still going to do our duty, what we did in the Blitz. We're still going to turn up after the nuclear bomb, after the thermonuclear bomb, with our blankets and our tea. And they were ridiculed, which is quite unfair because it was the world they knew and they wanted to carry on. But there was an article in The Guardian in the 80s which completely ridiculed them because at one of their conferences, they'd said they were going to do their Meals on Wheels service after the nuclear devastation. They were going to give out books to everyone who was in a welfare shelter, to alleviate boredom. And they were also going to give out jigsaws. And everyone latched onto that, jigsaws on wheels after Armageddon. And I hate to mock them because their heart was in the right place, but it was futile. A jigsaw and a cup of tea after nuclear war, no.
So in the atomic age, so you got like women coming to help and provide welfare. What attempt was made to actually protect the population in terms of deep shelters, and then provide for civil, ongoing government? Because I've been down some of the bunkers, places like Dover Castle, provide for resilience in government.
Well, there were no shelters at all for the population, which in the early Cold War came as a bit of a shock to the population because they assumed, well, the government looked after us in the Second World War. We had shelters in the back garden. We had communal shelters. We had the underground, of course. There was none of that at all in the Cold War. Again, the official reason was money. Britain, after the war, of course, we were a bit done in. We didn't have the money. And of course, if you're talking about an all-out nuclear war, you will need shelters for everyone in the population. It won't be a case of just the cities because you have fallout which can easily spread over the whole country. It goes wherever the wind takes it. So Britain did look at providing shelters for everyone all over the country, and it was deemed impossible. And I do agree with them. It would have bankrupted Britain to have provided shelters. So we had nothing unless you were quite well off and had the money to build your own shelter. There were plenty of companies who popped up in the 80s in particular who would build you a shelter in your back garden. But firstly, you had to have a garden. Lots of people in Britain, of course, live in flats and don't have a garden. And you needed, say, £10,000 to build this shelter. Some building societies were offering mortgages so you could build one of these shelters. Of course, you need the luxury of a garden and you need the luxury of 10 grand. A lot of people don't have that. So there were no shelters at all for the population unless you could build your own. The government, of course, as you said, they had plenty of bunkers all over the country, regional seats of government. And the idea for that was, after a nuclear war, we can assume London is gone. And so there'll be no Westminster, there'll be no Whitehall. So it will have to scatter across the country and break up into little chunks. And every Britain was cut up into civil defence regions. And each of these regions would have their own bunker filled with local councillors, local politicians, and with one cabinet minister striding in who'd effectively be the prime minister of that little region until the lovely day in the future where we were all able to reunite again and have a normal prime minister back in Whitehall.
So I've been to the big seat of government is it in the Cotswolds or where it's west of London, and they have a whole bank of phone books there. And that I was told by the guy, could well be an urban myth. The idea was you just start phoning people at random in the phone book and to get updates on whether people were still alive in that area. I don't know if that's something you've heard.
I hadn't heard of that. I had heard that in the advance of nuclear war and the run up to it, if you have a run up to it and you don't just get a bolt from the blue 4 minute warning attack, but if, as the government hoped or envisaged, there would be a period of international tension. There might even be a conventional war, which then goes nuclear. So in this run-up period, one of the measures they would employ is to cut off all the phone lines so that, you know, worried relatives can't phone their friends and relatives and say, what's happening? Where are you going? Can I come with you? Can I have your car, etc.? All the phone lines would be cut off, except for, of course, VIP lines. But if you were living in a normal residence and you picked up your phone and it was still working, then that was quite a sinister thing, because that meant the government had made sure your phone line was still working. And the implication there was your residence was earmarked for some kind of government use. So you might pick up your phone and go, oh, hi, I've still got a dial tone. But then you'd hear bang, bang, bang on the door and it'd be the men coming round to take your residence off you.
If you've always wanted to know more about some of the key events that shaped the medieval period and the modern world, then Gone Medieval from History Hit is the podcast for you. From this...
The king ordered all the Danish men who were in England to be killed because he'd heard a rumour that they were trying to topple him. They seemed to have been beheaded one by one in some kind of systematic manner.
To this.
The stakes are so high. Even when she first appears on the scene, Joan says, I've got 1 year to do this. So she knows that this is going to come to a sticky end.
With a whole lot of this in between.
The knightly class is a group of people who have been chosen by God. Armor is a physical proof that that's literally true.
With guests lined up at the drawbridge, it's time to let them in and begin the feast for your ears that is Gone Medieval. The podcast from History Hit. Together, my co-host Dr. Kat Jarman and I, Matt Lewis. We've gone medieval, and we're waiting for you to join us.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Was there a lot of sort of corruption? I mean, people must have, if you were in local government or in high up in the sort of, were there sort of people making plans to get their families to come with them? I mean, that would be a natural human reaction.
Yes. Lots of politicians assumed they could take their families, but they were told, no, you simply cannot. And of course, back in the Cold War, it was mainly men who would be doing this. It was mainly men who were in charge and would be expected to leave their wives and children at home. And a lot of these men said, I'm simply not doing it. They said, even in advance of it all, in a period of perfect peace, when everyone was calm, they said, strike my name off the list. I am not leaving my wife and kids to go to the bunker. A lot of people, of course, even politicians, particularly local politicians in what were called nuclear-free zones, Sheffield and Manchester local councils declared themselves nuclear-free zones and said, we're having nothing to do with this. We're not building a shelter. They were obliged to by law. But they said, we're not doing it, we're not going along with this silly charade. So they said, we're not going to build a shelter, and even if you force us to build one, I'm not turning up on the day, not leaving my wife and kids, not going along with your silly charade that by ducking into this shelter and allowing the population above ground to burn and die, we can keep Britain going. But of course, that was Whitehall's main concern. Once the hydrogen bomb came in and it was obvious that millions and millions of British people would die, we stopped thinking we can save people on the surface with blankets and jigsaws. The concern switched wholly to what they called continuity of government. The government's main concern must be making sure Britain continues, even if Britain is only a few guys in suits in a few bunkers. At least they can still come above ground eventually and wave a flag and say, Britain is still here. So, haha, to the Soviet Union, you didn't manage to wipe us out completely. There might just be 10 of us left. We are still Britain.
I just pick up one thing. So you talked about a four-minute warning, and that's presumably a submarine-launched warhead. In the North Sea, the time between that the strike being launched and it arriving above London is literally seconds almost.
Yes, that's right. The four-minute warning enters popular culture, of course, but it was accepted in government circles it would be less than 4 minutes. And as you say, if a sub launched from the North Sea, if they'd managed to get that far without being detected, then yes, we would have seconds of warning. There certainly wouldn't be the luxury of 4 minutes.
And what about the health service? Again, let's talk about the atomic age first. In terms of the health service, were plans made for the sort of catastrophic increase in the number of people requiring beds?
Yes, so there were plans to set up overflow hospitals. Now, of course, Britain, very, very densely packed, very crammed, so you don't have the luxury of lots of empty space where you could erect emergency hospitals or the money or the time to do it. So Aberdeen Council, for example, I found documents in the archives from them in the 60s where they sent some scouts, if you like, out to look at locations which could be used as emergency hospitals, and they chose nightclubs and restaurants because of course they have floor space which can be cleared and just filled with stretchers and beds. So Aberdeen listed the very poetic sounding Donald's Ballroom, and there was the Palais de Danse in Aberdeen, and these nightclubs would be cleared of all their paraphernalia, all their tables, etc., and just filled if needed with stretchers. And I just imagine how gruesome that would be. You've suffered awful blast injuries, or you're dying of radiation sickness, and you're dumped on the dance floor of Donald's Ballroom and you're dying under the glittering disco ball. It just shows how ridiculous it is. But at the same time, even though it's futile, there was still some goodness at the core of it. They were trying to help people. They were trying, even though we mock it and ridicule it now. At least they didn't sit back and see every man for themselves.
So, okay, so those are the preparations for an atomic strike. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, we developed these vast, terrifyingly powerful weapons, like the Tsar Bomber, you know, the biggest nuclear weapon ever detonated by the Russians.
Yeah.
Do they just give up then? So as you say, the government then just focuses on getting a few cabinet ministers underground with a couple of union flags.
Yes.
And does the NHS even bother at that point?
They were still planning, again, because they were obliged to plan. But the plans for the NHS became a lot darker. There was briefings, which I've seen from in the Royal College of Nursing, their archives, which was medical staff will be evacuated. So we can't evacuate the population. There's not enough time. There's no point because of fallout, etc. So scatter your nurses and doctors as far and wide as you can in the hope that at least pockets of them will survive. They will stay put in wherever they've been sent to, country houses or even cellars or basements somewhere. They will stay put until the radiation levels above ground fall, which of course might take weeks, depending on where you are, it might take weeks. And only once they've fallen to a safe level will the medics emerge and start trying to help people. So of course that means in the interim period, in those weeks, you're on your own. If you're injured, if you're dying, there's no one to help you. Obviously the most basic thing when you're in trouble in Britain, you pick up the phone and dial 999. That's gone. There's no one at all to help you. You're reliant completely on your family or on any first aid, which you might have learned, which is again where the Women's Royal Voluntary Service come in handy, because they had a scheme in the 60s called the 1 in 5 scheme. And this was a plan to reach 1 in 5 British women to teach them about the horrors of the nuclear bomb, the thermonuclear bomb, and how they can protect the household and the family, either by, you know, fortifying it against blast and fallout with the old chestnut of propping doors against the wall and sandbags at the windows. And also urged them to learn first aid and taught them some basic techniques. It taught them firefighting techniques also, these nice, prim, sensible housewives. So they could, until the doctors and nurses emerged, they could at least try and take care of their families. And it was called the 1 in 5 campaign because, this might sound quite sexist, but it was the 60s. The idea is that women gossip. So if you can get this lecture or message across to just one in five women, those women will then meet all their friends over coffee and lunch and tell everyone else, and it will gradually spread through the female population.
What about the anarchy that you mentioned at the start? Because I went to a nuclear bunker in Essex once, and there were some areas where machine guns could be mounted by the doors. And it struck me those weren't there to deal with a Soviet invasion. They were there probably to deal with desperate fellow British citizens.
That's right. There was a huge fear of anarchy after a nuclear war. One of the really unsettling things I've learned is there were plans on how to punish people after a nuclear war. So if you had looters and anarchy and murder, etc., you can't punish people by putting them in jail, because jail might actually be a luxury after a nuclear war, because you'll be given a bed and you'll be surrounded by nice thick stone walls to keep out the fallout. So prison was no longer a punishment. There's no point fining people because money's useless now. So the government had to look at different ways to punish people to, you know, keep a lid on any anarchy. And so execution, of course, was one of the things that was mooted. Execution squads, which would be done by soldiers, not policemen, done by the military. Another thing which was put forward as a suitable punishment, and which sounds quite sinister, is subject the criminal to public humiliation. And to me, that means like the medieval stocks, putting them back in the stocks, or even maybe just throwing them to the crowd. You know, this guy looted the local store and now we're out of food. Do what you want with them. That's why I take that to mean. It means mob rule, I suppose. Subject someone to public humiliation.
I mean, there can't be any more surprising documents in the nation's archives than stuff that was written sometimes in, you know, my lifetime.
Yes.
But which is advocating, you know, sort of blue sky thinking around the most unimaginable scenario. It's extraordinary.
Yes, it's still so close to us. The nuclear threat, of course, is always going to be with us. I don't think we can ever disarm. I think that's a wonderful idea, but I just don't think it's ever going to happen because of humans being what they are. So it's always with us, but during the Cold War, particularly in the 80s when it reached another spike, there was a Panorama episode called If the Bomb Drops in 1981, presented by Jeremy Paxman. Now, of course, Jeremy Paxman, you associate him now with Newsnight and politics and things which are worthy, of course, but maybe sometimes a bit dull, a bit humdrum. And yet in 1981, there was a perfectly ordinary Panorama episode about what will we do when the bomb drops, and it did cover execution. It did cover the fact that politicians who'd be in these local bunkers, if they had to deal with rioters and looters, then yes, they could arrange for people to be shot in the head. And this was just going out on the BBC on a normal, say, Monday night, and it was just ordinary. It's just what people had to deal with. And again, that's in my lifetime. I was born in 1980, and it's just incredible to think that was all going on when I was oblivious to it all.
You and I were bouncing on our parents' laps. Thank you very much. Amazing. That was so good. Actually, that was a tour de force.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland. further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.